Srimad Bhagavatam, chapter 20, text 15. Chidyamanam yamerete Krita nidam vanaspatim Kaga swaketam ushvijya Shemanyati yalampata Chijamanam, being cut down, yame, by cruel men who are like death personified, ete, by these, krita nidam, in which he has constructed his nest, vanaspatim, a tree, Kaga, a bird, Svakitam, his home, Uchija, giving up, Shema, happiness, Yati, achieves, he, indeed, Alampata, without attachment. Translation, without attachment, a bird gives up the tree in which his nest was constructed when that tree is cut down by cruel men who are like death personified. And thus the bird achieves happiness in another place. Please repeat. Without attachment, a bird gives up the tree in which his nest was constructed. When that tree is cut down by cruel men who are like death personified. And thus the bird achieves happiness in another place. Purport. Here the example is given of detachment from the bodily concept of life. The living entity resides within the body just as a bird dwells within a tree. When thoughtless men cut down the tree, the bird, without lamenting the loss of its previous nest, does not hesitate to establish its residence in another place. Amagina timhandasya gina gina salakaya chakshur unmilitam jena tasmai shri guruve namaha. So this is the 11th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, known as the Uddhava Gita. And the Uddhava Gita is sometimes placed on the same par of importance and beauty as the Bhagavad Gita. And earlier in, I think it's chapter 18 perhaps? No, it's chapter 19. In an earlier section in this part of the Bhagavatam, Uddhava asks Krishna, as Arjuna did, to please show me your opulences. And Krishna tells him at that time, previously I was asked this question on the battlefield of Kurukshetra by Arjuna. He asked me to show him my opulences, and I showed them to him then. And then he begins to speak very similarly to Bhagavad Gita, I am this, I am this, I am this, I am this. So this knowledge is very essential for us actually, because with our eyes, when we look around, we can only see the world. We can't see Krishna behind everything. It's as if there's a curtain, as it's described, and the curtain is closed right now, and so we see the activities going on in front of the curtain, but what is taking place behind we cannot see. Or it can also be compared to if you had a puppeteer. If you have these string puppets, the puppeteer is standing behind on a platform, and from the strings he's making these puppets dance, And the person who's watching can only see the little puppets and a slight amount of the string. Just a little bit they can see. But as they watch the dance, they begin to forget about the strings that are controlling, and they just watch the puppet dance. And they forget that the puppet is being manipulated by a puppeteer. So, interestingly enough, when preparing for this particular class, I conceived of the wrong verse. So I went on and prepared something for that particular verse, which will come later. And I've also been told that I'm supposed to cover text 14, which goes before text 15. And then we can consider some of the points. So text 14 is, a wise person, knowing that although the material body is subject to death, it can still award the perfection of one's life. You should not foolishly neglect to take advantage of this opportunity before death arrives. So this was prior to when death arrives, as compared to the unthinking, cruel men who cut down the tree. So I find it personally very interesting that one goes on with life absorbed in the current demands and realities. And they seem to be very important and very all-consuming. And when we look back, we see that we can understand there have been many previous things that were also important and all-consuming, but they're not there anymore. For example, if you have children, you can reflect back on when you had a baby and you're carrying a baby and the baby's needs were all important and consuming. Or if you don't have children, you can reflect back to when you were at school and you had to pass a particular examination and that was all important and consuming. And now you can ask yourself, where am I now? And this particular moment is also equally important and all-consuming. But if in the past it was like that, and in the future it's obviously going to be a continuation of the same thing, the question arises in a thoughtful person's mind, when do I get out? And how do I get out of this state of consciousness? How do I get out of the mindset that whatever is in front of me right now is so important that now is not the right time for me to draw my attention from that and focus it strongly on my Krishna consciousness? I'll do that later, but not right now. I've got some very, very demanding things. How does one challenge that illusion? Because it is an illusion. Because with our intelligence, as I said, you can trace your life back, and all those things are like waves of a river that have gone already. And even a small young child can look at another young child, younger than them, and think, I remember when I used to also cry in class, or I remember when I also used to need this and do this. So even at such a young age, you can see this going on, this progression of life, and its importance, or so-called importance, because, as we're hearing here, it's going to become cut down. So I'll continue reading on to the next couple of verses. So text 16 says, knowing that one's duration of life is being similarly cut down by the passing of days and nights, one should be shaken with fear. So who amongst us enjoys being shaken with fear? I think nobody really wants to be shaken with fear. We do everything in our possibility that we can not to be shaken with fear. Right? If some situation comes and it's quite frightening, we rationalize in so many ways. We look at our resources. We try to avoid that situation. We can all relate to these different reactions to fear. But here we're being asked to be shaken by fear. So you see sometimes if a child is misbehaving, you may shake them to get them to pay attention. And they may need to feel for a moment some fear that the behavior that I'm exhibiting is inappropriate. And if I continue in this way, I might get some punishment. But then, a loving parent doesn't continue to shake the child with fear, But the shaking is for a moment to get their attention. And then one is asked to direct one's attention correctly, properly. So the first thing that is being recommended here to stop this ever-continuous flow of this is important and that's important and I don't have time and when I do have time I will do such and such is to be shaken with fear. To understand you don't have all the time in the world and neither do you know when death is going to come. And every so often in a devotee community you'll see something that will happen that will be considered by everyone to be tragic. And this is very important because suddenly everyone realizes, oh my gosh, I don't have all the time in the world. So then, this verse says, in this way, having been shaken by fear, by seeing one's days and nights passing, giving up material attachment, all material attachment and desire, one understands the Supreme Lord and achieves perfect peace. Perfect peace. Because everyone is looking for peace. So many times I remember traveling in the trains in India when people would look and they would see I'm wearing a sari and they'd come and sit down very curiously wanting to know something. And they'd say, so you are wearing our dress? And you'd say, yes. And then they would say, so you are doing spiritual, religious activities? And say, yes. And immediately they'd say, have you found peace? Have you found peace? And if I would say no, then they would move away. And if I would say yes, then they would continue the conversation because they were looking for peace. But devotees, as people, as human beings, we're seeking peace. But as devotees, we're not seeking peace. What are we seeking instead? Service. And why are we seeking service? What is service the end, the means to the end of? What's that? End of suffering. That's in the beginning stages. One thinks that way. But when one is advanced, what does one think? My service is the pathway to? Krishna prema, to love, yes, to love. My service is not my passport to love. And love is actually what we need. Just like in the 1970s, there was a popular song, All You Need Is Love. But at that particular point, I think everyone was really actually meaning to say, all you need is lust. But for us, we understand, no, all I need is love. Or we're trying to understand that. As was mentioned, right now we're at the point that if I do this service, it will free me from suffering. This is the beginning of this wonderful journey. So the next verse. The human body, which can award all benefit in life, is automatically obtained by the laws of nature, although it is a very rare achievement. Now this is interesting. Did you hear the two things that were in that sentence? What was the first one? Yes, it's automatic, it's easy to obtain. And the second one was? It's very rare. Now isn't that a little bit interesting, the combination of these two things? You'll automatically get it and it's very rare. If somebody said to you like that with your bank, with a large amount of money, you'll automatically get it, but it's very rare. You'd wonder if they were kind of like, sort of like double talking. You know, it's automatic but very rare. So the intelligence can pick up on that. What is this automatic but very rare? This human body can be compared to a perfectly constructed boat, having the spiritual master as the captain and the instructions of the personality of Godhead as favorable winds, impelling it on its course. Considering all these advantages, a human being who does not utilize his human life to cross the ocean of material existence must be considered the killer of his own soul. Somebody who does not use his human life to finish things off, to keep moving towards emancipation, freedom from this entanglement. The entanglement of feeling that I have so many important things to do that I cannot fully focus on Krishna right now. This is the entanglement. the details of each one of our particular entanglement, my entanglement, your entanglement, somebody else's, they're very specific. But the disease, the problem, is common to everyone. A transcendentalist, having become disgusted and hopeless in all endeavors for material happiness, completely controls the senses and develops detachment. By spiritual practice, he should then fix the mind on the spiritual platform without deviation. Now, this is where I began to prepare my class. It's a few verses ahead. And in reading this about the spiritual determination and fixing the mind on the spiritual platform, I was made aware of, again, another apparent contradiction, where on one hand we're told so many negative things about the mind. The mind is the source of all our problems. The mind is like this. The mind is like that. You have to control your mind. Oh, it's just in your mind. You're very mental today. It's just this, so on and so forth. And on the other hand, we're told that the mind is false ego in the mode of goodness. It's in the mode of goodness, the mind. So how can the mind be in the mode of goodness? And the Bhagavatam explains this in the third canto. And yet the mind seems to be such a rascal that we are given so many critical thoughts. So what I did was I spent some time trying to understand the relationship between the mind and the mode of goodness, or in other words, with elevation, if the mind is such a crucial problem. So I found some things I would like to share with you about that helped me a little bit to get a clearer picture of what is our situation and why it's difficult for us to become Krishna conscious. What we have to, and we cannot, again, a contradiction of terms, we have to do this and we cannot do this. And we cannot take away the fact that you have to do it. And we cannot take away the fact that you cannot do it. So again, two things have to be going at the same time. The self-centered materialistic ego. The materialistic ego is the first thing that's created in the material creation. Before you come into this material world, you cannot come here without an ego. What does an ego mean? Identity. So you can't have a non-identity. If you walk in the room here, somebody will know, oh, that's a lady, that's a man, that's somebody from India, that's somebody who's old, that's somebody who's young. Immediately you're given an identity. Of course, unless you're in a mental body, and what is it if you're only in a mental body? That's a ghost. A ghost can come here and do anything they want, and we won't necessarily give them an identity because we can't see them. But if we can see them, they require an identity. So to come into the material world, the first thing that's created is this sense of identity. There is no form to your identity yet, but you have a sense, a potency for an identity. And this identity has to be self-centered. Self-centered means two things. Again, you can call self-centered meaning extremely selfish, right? You say to somebody, you're so self-centered. It means you're so selfish. But it also means you're so centered on yourself. You're so focused on yourself. So as soon as the soul acquires a false identity, they have nothing but that. That's now their identity. And so when they come in touch then with this materialistic ego, the next thing that takes place is they come in contact with the modes of goodness, passion and ignorance. Because these are like the construct of the material, the materialistic world is composed of these. And many elements. So you have so many elements, like as if you were making a cake. You have so many elements and you have some milk. And you're going to place so much of these into the bowl, then you're going to pour in the milk or the fluid and mix that together and you've got the beginning of a cake. And then you put it into an experience, which is like the oven, and there comes out the cake. So the soul comes into this world and is somehow by inconceivable way amalgamated within these elements and these modes. And then on a long journey of many sequential experiences takes birth. and takes birth and then takes birth. The next birth is according to the last birth. What the desires of the last birth were, that dictates the next birth. And each birth, your desires in that birth are not fulfilled in that birth. Your desires will be fulfilled in the next birth. This is the delayed process, you could say, of karma. Now, here's something interesting. If one is very steady and in the mode of goodness, and very steady, then his desires in his last birth and his desires in his next birth will be very similar. And so when he comes into his next birth, he will want something similar to what he had before, and he'll get it because he's following on in this way. And do you know what that is called? What is that called? Is this a fire alarm? Or a mobile phone? So, no problem. No problem. So, if one desires in one life and desires the same thing in the next life and receives the things from the last life in this life, what will that result in? How will he feel? How would you feel? If yesterday you wanted something, you want it today, and you get it today, how would you feel? You'd feel good, you'd feel happy, right? Because I wanted it, and it's come. But if in your last life you wanted one particular thing, and in your next life, for some reason, you want something different, then when the things of last life come, they're not what you want this life, what will you feel? Unhappy. You'll feel unsatisfied. You'll feel distressed. You'll feel like, what is this? I don't want this. I want this. Why am I getting this? Why is this happening to me? Let me work this out. I have a good, strong intelligence. I can figure this out. I'll just do a little manipulation here and a little manipulation there, and then I'll get what I want. But there's a delay inherent within the process of achievement of one's karmic reactions. And so one will spend one's whole life fighting against these unfavorable things that have come, which previously I wanted, but now I don't want them. And this is how one life to the next life to the next life goes by. And someone may achieve all the things in last life they wanted it, and steadily they proceeded, and here are the fruits, and then they see somebody else who has that, and that's nicer than this, and so they start a new chain of desires. Oh, I used to think it was nice to live in India, but now I'd love to see the West. I wonder what it's like in Melbourne, Australia. And boom, and it appears as though you just got that now. But that must have been there in your heart previously. And now if you change again, that's coming in the future. And people do not understand this. They think, I desire and then I get. It's just immediate. I want a car and I get a car. I want this, because this is how meticulous the material energy is. It appears as though there's like a magic way that we're in control of everything. But factually speaking, we're in control of none of it. We're being actually taken on a journey. And on our journey we see, this is most important. Now that's most important. Now I want this. Now I want that. And as I said, we go down the river of life, just observing the particular wave that's right in front of us. And we finish our life. And when did we think about Krishna? How much did we think about Krishna? How important was it to us to remember Krishna? It was there. We'll certainly get an opportunity for more Krishna consciousness in our next birth. But we may not get an opportunity to be relieved of material suffering and happiness because we didn't want that. So for every devotee, this is a very important point, to observe and see, what do I want? How much do I want it? I say I want Krishna. What degree do I want Krishna? What percentage of my time do I spend in wanting Krishna? And how much of my time is spent in wanting other things? And if that's the case, What do I do about it? Now, you're going to come further on in this process of pure devotional service, chapter 20, to a section of the Srimad Bhagavatam that I used to find one of my favorite sections. For many, many years, it was one of my favorite areas of instruction and advice, because Krishna is going to tell Uddhava how to control the mind in a very simple formula. This will come, so I won't go too far ahead. And then in the purport, further from that, there's a wonderful purport where it explains for one like us, who's struggling like us, not for one who has wholehearted determination, but for one who has small-hearted determination, there's a wonderful prayer that's given, and a wonderful reflection on the condition that we find ourselves in. And there, in the purport, the acharyas have explained that we should look at our life and understand that I may be where I am right now. I may still have an attachment to sense gratification. I may still have an attachment to worldly desires. So how can I pray? This is what he says. Prayer. The word dridha nichaya, or steadfast conviction, indicates that in any circumstance a devotee is completely determined to go on with his prescribed duties to Krishna. Again, another contradiction. I've just recognized that I'm not at all determined. So how can I say I'm completely determined? This can become bewildering. We can also sometimes think, well, how can I pray? If I see how many material desires I have, what kind of a prayer can I offer to Krishna? So this is the kind of complete determination that is being referred to here. Thus he thinks, so this is not exactly a prayer, but it can be a prayer. Thus a person who has this complete determination and lack of determination, he thinks, by my previous shameful life, my heart is polluted with many illusory attachments. Personally, I have no power to stop them. Only Krishna within my heart can remove such inauspicious contamination. But whether the Lord removes such attachment immediately or lets me go on being afflicted by them, I will never give up my devotional service to him. Even if the Lord places millions of obstacles in my path, and even if because of my offenses I go to hell, I will never for a moment stop serving Krishna. This is very interesting. This is a very subtle prayer. It's not one of those kind of black and white prayers, because here the person is admitting, I can't do it, I don't do it, I'm very fallen, I'm very far away from this, but still I will never give it up. So this platform anyone can attain to if they're sincere, anyone, on any level. The exalted standards of devotional service, the exalted standards that are here in this section of the Uddhava Gita, of what is vanashram, what is your duty, how you should do things, this should be like this, that should be like that, everything ideal, none of us can attain to or practice. None, no one can practice these things in this Kali Yuga age. So then the question becomes, if I can't practice it, what's the relevance to me? Maybe I should sort of like set that part of the Bhagavatam aside, because that's too hard, I can't practice that. But interestingly enough, that's not the way the process works. One should read it, and what it will do, at least it's what it did to me, and I think it must do for anyone who reads it sincerely, it will make you feel very embarrassed, and it will make you feel very, very fallen. And it will make you feel that you haven't got any hope at all. What's the chances for you? You're so incompetent. You have none of the right attitudes or experiences to practice this. So I might as well give up. No, Because if you give up, you won't be able to make this prayer. This is the prayer for us. I cannot give up my attachments. I have no power to give them up. But I will not give up my service. Because my service is what is going to get me love. And if I get that love, and if Krishna removes these things, then, only then, can I attain the perfection of devotional life. Not by my own endeavors. It's only in the beginning that some people think that I'll sort all my life out and get rid of all the problems. And of course, very soon you see, actually I don't have any strength like that. But I cannot give up my service. I am not interested in mental speculation and fruitive activities. And even if Lord Brahma personally comes before me offering such engagements, I will not be even slightly interested. Now, perhaps some of us can't relate to that. We might be slightly interested, so we may not be able to say that. But he says, although I am attached to material things, I can see very clearly that they lead to no good, because they simply give me trouble and disturb my devotional service to the Lord. This every one of us will be able to see. If we cannot see it moment by moment, then don't worry, this realization will come, that these material things are distracting me from my devotional service and they're giving me trouble. Therefore, I sincerely repent my foolish attachments to so many material things, and I am patiently awaiting Krishna's mercy. So this prayer used to oftentimes give me some consolation, because I couldn't pray the wonderful prayers. I couldn't perform the wonderful activities. I was immersed in the next wave of the river of life. So this prayer was something that I could hold on to. So in this section, previous, this is pure devotional service that is being discussed. But when Uddhava asked Krishna to explain his opulences, and he explained them, there's a very nice section of verses that I thought I would read again to you, because this is our service. Krishna is saying this to Uddhava. Firm faith in the blissful narration of my pastimes. Constant chanting of my glories. Unwavering attachment to worship of me. Praising me through beautiful hymns. Great respect for my devotional service. Offering obeisances with the entire body. Performing first class worship of my devotee. Consciousness of me in all living entities. Offering of ordinary bodily activities in my devotional service. Offering of ordinary bodily activities in my devotional service. Use of words to describe my qualities. Offering your mind to me. Rejecting material desires. Giving up wealth for my service. Renouncing material sense gratification and happiness. And performing all desirable activities such as charity, sacrifice, chanting, vows and austerities. Charity, sacrifice, chanting, vows and austerities. Performing all those kinds of activities with the purpose of achieving me. The purpose has to be changed. The platform has to be changed. Changed from this self-centered material ego, wherein the mode of goodness creates the mind, the mode of passion creates the intelligence, the mode of ignorance creates the desire to interact with the sense objects. And there we are, stuck. And here we are, stuck. And this is the way to get out. These constitute actual religious principles by which those human beings who have actually surrendered themselves to me automatically develop love for me. What other purpose or goal could remain for my devotee. Thank you very much. Does anyone have any questions? Yes.
The mind comes from a combination of all seasons plus more of it.
Yes. That was the question that I was asking myself. That's why I was trying to read and find something about that. It seems that the three functions are functions of the ahankar, the mind, the intelligence, and the willing power, thinking, feeling, and willing. So the mind, when we talk about the mind and we talk about intelligence, sometimes they're defined differently in Shastra. But it's also referred to that the intelligence is the mind has the ichha shakti, the desires. The mind is constantly filling with desires. And the passion or the intelligence is the kriya shakti, or the activity is carried out by intelligence. So you have to use the activity to control them. Desires, so forth. Normally, for an ordinary person, the desires are controlling the activity. But for somebody who's trying to become devotional, they have to change the activity, and then they can start to change the desires. Because it's a reversal, right? You're going this way, or you're going that way. So the first step is always to perform the activities, as we heard here. Here is a wonderful list of activities. One can, by performing those activities, one can control the mind. So the intelligence has to be activated in order to do that. Any other questions? Very fascinating subject, isn't it? Yes.
You said there should be a desire of saying, I will not give up my service.
Yes.
Even if the other desires are very strong and we don't yes. have any control of controlling those desires.
Yes.
Sometimes the desire of service may not be there, even though.
Yes, that's a good point.
Lectures, you know, this is not the.
So if I understood you correctly, or perhaps your question comes to my question, if I have material desires, how can I have a desire for service? The desire for service will be removed by the material desires. So this is true. So therefore one has to maintain some degree of association with people who have a desire for service in order to strengthen the intelligence to at least be able to sort of be drowning and put your hand up. You know, sometimes I've counseled devotees, and at the point that you're talking at them to them, they can't put their hand up. They can't say, I want to be free of this. They can't do that. And then you have to spend quite a bit of time with them talking from different angles, trying to help them to see in this way. To see that, and you have to strengthen their intelligence. Do you see that your life is going like this? Look at this, look at this, look at that, look at this. So here the intelligence comes in to try to reform the mind's desires. But the mind is so fickle. It's sankalpa and vikalpa actions. It's going like this, like this, like this, like this. And so if one's intelligence is strengthened, it can't overpower necessarily your attachments or your lower nature, but it's going to definitely help. So then when the intelligence is strengthened, then you have to go to these activities and try to perform them just a little bit, even against your own lack of desire, and you'll see a result. You'll see an immediate perceptible result, but it won't be to overcome all the material attachments and material desires. That won't be the result you'll see. But you'll have a moment of clarity. And then if you're fortunate, because there's some good fortune has to be there also, and you stay with the association of people who are trying to strengthen your clarity of mind, then a little more clarity will come. And just like in Melbourne, so many times you see the clouds are covering the whole sky, right? And then one little section will clear and you see, oh, the blue sky is there. Amazing. And one ray will come and all of a sudden the whole courtyard will be illuminated and everyone will feel happiness. They didn't even notice why, but they feel happy now. And then again the cloud will come and that will be removed. So those moments, we have to retain them somehow, somewhere in our the basket of our mind. We may forget them, but if we're fortunate, Krishna will come again and say, you remember when? Try it again. And in the beginning it's a little difficult because we have 100% materialistic thoughts, and now we've got 1% spiritual and 99%. You know, it's a little, the odds are against us. But in any tenacious minded person in any kind of situation knows that I have to do a bit more. Not that I'm going to now overcome this 99% on this side and shift it like that. That's unrealistic. Can you do that in business? Can you do that in anything? But I need a bit more on that side. And so then you start looking for the formulas how to do it. Just like nowadays, I think it's quite everybody's experience that if you want to know about something, you get onto the computer and you Google it and you try to find out more on that. So we must try to cultivate that same focused interest in finding out more about this, rather than thinking sometimes, this is so great and it's so ideal and I'm so far from there that I just don't think this is going to help me at all. It's not relevant to where I am. No, we should have a courage to try and find something that will be helpful for us at our particular point. Anything else? Yes, Prabhu. Hari Bhu. Yes.
Can you tell us what is Krishna consciousness? What time we are on this Krishna? Can we read what is Krishna consciousness?
Ekeha Kuru Nandana, ek, one, right? One mind. Now we have so many departments. Like I see from my own experience of a computer that what it does is it allows you to do 10 or 12 things at the same time, and therefore what it does is it divides your attention into 10 or 12 parts. And none of them can be very thorough because they're all there at the same time. So that's what a many-branched mind is like. It's like a person on a computer going, oh, I can keep that there, I'll answer this, I'll talk on this, I'll do this, all at the same time. So it's kind of like as if a many-branched mind has been manifest for the benefit of society in a physical form. So anyone can get a many-branched mind just by a computer, and you will develop one. So we can see that, what that means, what that's like. Now how to get an Ekeha Kuru Nandana? How to get our mind back so it's in one place? But this is the whole process of Krishna consciousness. And how do we do it? Initially, we try to use our many-branched mind in Krishna's service. As many branches as we can. We try to use them. We try to dedicate them. We try to place our ordinary day-by-day life in front of Krishna saying, I'm trying to do this for your pleasure. And in the beginning, we won't be necessarily very successful at doing that. Most of the time, we won't be doing that. But this is the process that Krishna is giving. And he's saying, you do this, you follow this path, and at some point, when you're mature, when you reach your perfection of this, there'll only be one thing in your life and your mind. There'll be, how can I attain my loving service directly to Krishna? How can I get that? I've done everything else. I've figured it out. I don't need that. I don't need this. I don't want this. How can I get this? And that becomes this Ekeha Kuru Nandana. And for us, so that we can sort of have a wonderful example of that, Srila Prabhupada traveled around the world from place to place, especially here in Melbourne. He came many times. And he exhibited this consciousness so perfectly that it was kind of, it was almost shocking how one-minded he was. How his mind didn't waver. And in front of him, you'd feel very nervous because you felt like he could see all the waverings, like all the vibrations that were going on inside of you. And of course he could, but he wasn't interested in that. He could also see you, whom you couldn't see. And he would speak to you. And it was the most extraordinary thing because no one has ever done that, spoken to you. We speak to each other as our bodies. One time it was in Durban, I think, there's a wonderful lecture with Srila Prabhupada. It's a Bhagavad Gita lecture. I don't remember what verse it is. And it was perhaps the first time I heard Srila Prabhupada use this analogy, and I've heard him say it many times since. But he was speaking to this audience, and he said to the man that was speaking to him, and I don't know if it was in a question, but I just remember that the people in the audience cheered. There was like an ovation. And he explained to this man, "You are seeing your father. Your father is lying on the bed. But now your father has died. And your father is lying there before you. And I say to you, no, your father is here. And you say, no, my father has passed on. He's gone. And I tell you, that means you have never seen your father." And when Prabhupada said that, the whole audience cheered. They suddenly got it for a moment. But that's not my father. My father's gone. At the time of death, you're forced to see this. But life is so overwhelmingly, illusorily complicated and entangling that we can't think like that. We think, no, this is my father, this is my mother. What would I do if I thought like that? Let me just go on. But at that point, it's so profound. Because the soul has gone. The body's still there. And Prabhupada went on. You say, I'll say to you, no, your father's still there. No, he's gone. No, he's still there. No, he's gone. So it becomes very clear. So this is single-mindedness. That Srila Prabhupada didn't go from that point of clear, pure consciousness. He never shifted into another state of consciousness. And people traveled with him. They traveled with him. They saw him in so many circumstances. And they were amazed because he just didn't come down to a bodily level at all. When he was traveling in India in 1970, he took a small group, initially maybe 12 or 14 devotees. They were called the World Sankirtan Party. And he took his most senior disciples with him to India because he wanted to break a new frontier. At that particular point, there was no preaching going on in India at all. He had left India, gone to America, and in America he had opened up many temples. And he had now disciples also in England and some places in Europe and Canada. And so he told them, he chose a group and he took them back to India. And they were so trained that I was listening on the DVDs. You can see this for yourself. On the DVD it was explaining that they were explaining that everywhere we stopped on the train, now if you're going to travel from Delhi to Mumbai and back, every stop we got off the train at the stop and began kirtan on the platform. We were so trained. If you go to an airport, we had kirtan. Of course the airports were much more liberal than modern technologically controlled airports. But everywhere, in Cairo they got off the plane with machine guns in the hands of the guards who were watching them and just started having kirtan because that was their work. And when Prabhupada got them to India, he was tireless, and they're all young in their 20s. Should have their best energy then. But Prabhupada would go from morning until 11 o'clock at night having programs. One program after another program after another program after another program. And they described, we were like ducklings. We just followed behind him. We didn't know what he was doing. But he'd go from this place to that place. Someone invite him to another state. He'd go there. He'd go here. He'd take them here. He'd have a pandal over here. He'd go to Delhi. He was traveling from Delhi back to Bombay from Kashmir, I think it was. Where the Golden Temple is. Yes, and he was in Delhi, and one gentleman on the train just before he got to Delhi got in, a sort of a homely looking fellow, nobody very important, and asked Prabhupada, please come to Delhi to my house. And he was going to Bombay, So immediately he turned to Gurudas, who was his servant at the time, and said, you should get down in Delhi and start a temple. This was how he thought. Find some of the men on the train, get down to Delhi and start a temple. Just like that, they had to get off with their baggage, with nothing, and go to some man's house. And then the Prabhupada had a formula, and they were following his formula. And so they were likewise empowered by Srila Prabhupada's power, but they all understood that it was Prabhupada who was doing it, and everything was coming from him. So even now, if we forget that it's Prabhupada who embodies all these things, we'll make a great mistake. We'll make a great mistake, and we'll miss out on the greatest source of shelter that's available in this world. Because even if we try to approach the deities, just imagine, we can approach the deities, but just imagine if Srila Prabhupada was standing before us and he approached the deities and said, this poor soul is struggling in so many ways, you please bless him. Do you think it would be more potent? Unlimitedly more potent. So Srila Prabhupada's mercy is essential for us if we want to make advancement in spiritual life. And this is the secret, actually, of success and getting this Ekeha, Kuru Nandana, following somebody who has it. You may follow at a great distance, or you may feel unworthy to follow, but you'll understand it if you find somebody who has it. Any other questions? Yes, Mataji. Yes. Yes. We try. We don't say, like, there was a fallacious way of thinking, a faulty way of thinking that came about just after Srila Prabhupada left, where people began to see they were a little more mature than they were in earlier years, and they began to think, oh, I'm seeing that Krishna consciousness is going to take me quite a long time. I thought because of the heat, the excitement of Srila Prabhupada's presence, that Krishna consciousness, realization and perfection was just around the corner. So I'm working very hard, but now I'm feeling like, oh, it's going to take a very long time. So then the faulty argument, the faulty reasoning was, well, if it's going to take a long time, if it's going to be a long time before I get there, let me slow down. But think about that for a minute. It's very clear how illogical that is. It's already going to take you a long time, and now it's going to take you twice as long. They're simple. It's a common sense. If it's going to take a long time and I have to do it, I may sometimes slow a little bit. I may have to slow down. But I shouldn't consciously say, oh, it's going to take a long time, so let me not do the best I can do with it. So similarly, with our weaknesses, we shouldn't say, well, I have a weakness, so I don't need to worry about that weakness. I'll just leave that. I won't think about that. That's not important. No, we have to still be aware of it, and we have to manage it. We have to manage as best we can, as seriously as we can. But if we find ourselves not becoming successful in our management of it, we should not become hopeless. That is the point. Another lecture Prabhupada was talking, he was going on and on and on about, you know, all the standards of things. One should be like this, one should not do this, one should, and he was going on and on. And it was in San Francisco, I think, in the very early days. And even I was listening to it and feeling more and more glum as he was describing these high standards, one after another. Shouldn't even think of this, one should become firmly determined, fixed, on and on. And then Prabhupada said, and it was very sweet in the tone of his voice, he said, and so should we become hopeless? No. So again, one of these contradictions. It's very rarely achieved, but it's automatically achieved. You have to be worried, but you shouldn't be hopeless. Everything has these two aspects. And I think in a practical sense, when you're being lazy with yourself, then you should be shaken with fear. And when you're not being lazy and you're endeavoring as best you can, then you should be encouraged not to be hopeless. But when you're being lazy, that's not when you should tell yourself, oh, I need not be hopeless. No, you have to take responsibility to shake yourself. What am I doing? I'm doing this again. I don't want to do this. Let me go back over here. And then when I'm distressed, oh my gosh, I'm not getting anywhere. Don't worry. It's coming. It's coming. Krishna will take care of you. They both always have to be like the two ropes, like Mother Yasoda, the 2 inches. Krishna's mercy and our endeavor both have to be sufficient to get out of the material world. And until we get out of the material world, Krishna promises to protect all of us. And our business is to try to remain conscious of his protection. Any other points? Yes.
I find when I stay in India, all the shaitan and messy body in the road, which I often see there.
Yes.
Living in Western world, I'm shielded from such a shame.
Yes. Well, you can always Google. You can Google dead bodies and see if you can shake yourself off a little bit. But you know, there's something very strange. Sometimes we'll be shaken, but we've become so callous by way of this modern technological, you know, availability of a war. You can go and look at, you know, the people dying in Haiti when they're dying. You can observe like a football match, you know, instead of a soccer match, you can observe a war taking place. You know, it makes you so callous. It's so unreal. It's so unreal. So how do we get our shake up? Sometimes Krishna says, oh, poor Chandrasekhar Prabhu, he's not getting shaken up enough. Let me find something to shake him up with. So we should sort of like hold on, you know. He says, okay, here's a shake up coming. You need one. So he's in your heart. He says, okay, he needs a shake up. But yes, we do get shaken up. Things are more ugly in India. Much more ugly, much more real. And here everything is under plastic, you know, and it's all hidden from us, removed immediately. So we may not have any disturbance in our sense enjoyment, because if we're disturbed in our sense enjoyment, we may not consume as much. And that's the main issue. We have to consume. If we don't keep consuming, even things we don't need, if we don't keep buying them and buying them and buying them, how will our society work? So your moral duty is to buy things, even if you don't need them, so we can continue with this. Wait a minute. That in itself should shake you up. Look at the logic. If you can't get the emotional shake up, use your intelligence to get a shake up. Look at where we're going. Look where the world is leading us. Any other points? Thank you. Yes. Yes. Is a pure desire, is this your question? Is a pure desire to serve Krishna, once you have that, is it permanent? Yes. Yes. But you may only have 1% in your bank account of pure desire to serve Krishna. That's permanent. But you might have 99% of other desires. So you may get distracted into the other desires and waste some time. But what you put in there permanent, that's permanent. Because that's reality. You've got the tip of the iceberg of reality there already. It's yours. Yes. Do we already have? Yes. We already have the desire to serve Krishna, but it's become dormant, because our consciousness, which is the symptom of the soul or life in a body, our consciousness has become covered by this ahankar in the mode of goodness, passion and ignorance. And now we think, when I say, do I already have it, I'm thinking, this is me. Do I already have it? And here's, so here's another contradiction. No, your mind and body don't have it. You have it. But, and then until we can, until we're fortunate enough to be able to discern that I am not my mind and body, I'm wearing them. And you can understand by logic that that would be similar to wearing clothes. You might like your clothes. Or Prabhupada said driving a car, you might think, I'm very attached to this car, I bought it. So he's making this point. You have an attachment to the car, you have an attachment to your clothes, but you're more attached to you. And if the car breaks down or the clothes are taken away, you'll live on. Even you might lament for some time. So when that awareness that I'm actually, I'm beginning to perceive through the foggy Melbourne clouds, I'm beginning to see some sort of signs of blue sky. That's clear consciousness. Then I'm beginning to actually have not a deep understanding, but a sense that maybe I'm not these things. And I've had experiences also that tend to confirm that I'm not my body. And if I don't believe it, if I can't get shaken up by seeing dead bodies, then just wait and pray that you get an opportunity to see somebody leave their body. It's amazing. Because 1 minute they're breathing, there's activity going on in that body, and the next minute the body's like a shell and there will be no more movement coming from the body, only a gurgle. So what happened? If you can't see it there, you've got no intelligence. What happened? Why is that person no longer breathing? Somebody left. And now the body is there. And the Bhagavatam in this section is telling us, get yourself ready, because death, you don't know when it's coming. So get ready, put some attention on this. And we're saying, if you can't put all your attention on it, because you have so many other desires, that's all right. Put some of your attention there. And as you are asking, whatever attention you put there, that's permanent. That's rewarded to you. But now you've got to try and put more. Try and put more. Each one of us has the same challenge. How we do it is individual. But we should try and put more. And is the desire to serve Krishna already there? Yes. It's an uncovering process. It's not a manufacturing process. So imagine how happy we would be if we came in touch with ourselves. We would become so totally happy that all of these attachments and things would just sort of seem like somebody playing the radio in the house next door. It would seem so distant and inconsequential. But now it's like listening to them right in our ear. So therefore we pray to Krishna in this humble way. Please help me. I'm full of material desires, but I still don't want to give up my service to you. Does that answer your question? Do you have any other questions on that? Do you have any further point? Okay. All right. Okay. Anybody else? It's so valuable when people ask questions. I heard one time on a lecture in Hawaii, Prabhupada was asking, any questions? And nobody asked a question. And so then he started on about the value of questions, and he stopped again and said, any questions? And nobody asked a question. And so he started talking again, he went on and on and again, trying to sort of, fuel the fire, and no one asked. And then he said, all right, let us have kirtan. The questions are very valuable, because sometimes somebody gets brave enough to ask a question that we're too shy to ask, and then you receive an answer that you were hoping you could receive indirectly, hoping, but you get it from somebody else's bravery. Yes. It's coming up. It's this chapter 20, 11th Canto, chapter 20, and it's so you'll get a chance to hear it again. It is verse 28, chapter 20. That whole section is very nice. It talks about also how you to control the mind. Sometimes you have to let it out a little bit first. If you pull it in too hard, then it will rebel. So you have to give it a little rein, and then with a little, give it a little opportunity, then you can move it to the right path, like a horse. So these are all very valuable instructions that we need sometimes to have explained to us in our personal situations, but they're very valuable general instructions also. Yes. Fearlessness. Fearlessness is a tall order. How to develop fearlessness? You have to give up ahankar. As long as you have a false ego, there'll be fear. Fear is not so easy to get rid of. It's just like if somebody said to me one time, how can I give up anger? And I said, you can't. It's an element. It's a rasa. You can't give it up. It's a secondary rasa. It exists in the spiritual world. Now, you could, instead of giving it up, you can ask, how can I purify it or use it? That's a more constructive question. How can I use my anger? And Prabhupada says, you turn your anger towards people who are inimical to Krishna. Or you turn, and sometimes you'll see, perhaps you have to be a little angry at yourself as one of those people. And the same thing, how do I use fear in Krishna's service? I have to be afraid of the right things, and I have to find out what are the right shelters which I shouldn't be afraid of. So I have to do some research. You can take your question, you can put the word fearlessness and take it to the Veda base and put it in as a query, fearlessness, and you'll find that you put that in as a question and probably there'll be 500 different quotes on how to become fearless, and you read them all and you'll get many, many things from that. You have to do some work to try to become fearless, because it's natural to be fearful in this material world. It's completely natural. And one time I heard a quote, it was, struck me, it said, if you're in some situation and everyone's frightened and one person's not, it usually means he doesn't know what's going on. So sometimes we can be fearless like that, but that's not what the Bhagavatam is talking about. It's talking about stepping across the fear to the platform of fearlessness on the other side. All right, if there are no more questions, we can go on with our day. Thank you very much. Hari Bol.
Thank you very much.